Well, part of that's like learning a foreign language again. You mean, you really have to know the language.
One thing we didn't talk about that, again, Ted Cairns fostered was that by the late 50s, there was still not much contact with German universities in particular, but European and American companies. And Ted started a program here of sending folks over, staff members, what have you, over to visit European universities and give lectures. And the first time I went was in 1960. That's before the Berlin Wall, and East Berlin was lying in ruins still. And the Germans treated all Americans as though we were Christ coming back out from the dead. They loved us and all. Well, as a matter of fact, most Europeans did, except the English, I guess. But I went over that first time in 1960 and made a grand tour and met Eschenholzer. He was a young guy, was my host at Etaha, and met Prelog, and met Wittig, and all of them, everybody. And went to France and Switzerland, Germany, England, and the Netherlands. And spent a month or so over there in a car with my wife, just going around and giving talks and meeting people. And part of that was to invite them back over here. We had a program, which this meant a great deal, because the young Germans in those days, there was no money to come to visit them. So we would pick two or three young, promising academics and have them come here, give a lecture, and then pay for two or three weeks of travel anywhere they wanted to go in the United States to talk at universities. God, they again thought we were the savior had come to do. This is a very popular program, obviously. And I started going every two or three years to Germany and made close friends with a lot of these people. George Wittig, these were all folks who would I eventually knew pretty well, who would have you to their home for dinner and vice versa. Oh my goodness, the guy at Munich, the University of Munich, Rolf Wiesken, was another that I got to know very well, and Rolf and I correspond still, he's sort of fun to, because he has always a lot of gossip about what's going on in the world of chemistry. Ivar Ugi, the Privat docent at Munich, practically thrown out by Wiesken when I first met him, and then he went off to become the head of corporate research at Bayer and Leverkusen, and then came to the United States, was a professor at USC, and then went back, and he's the professor at the Technical University of Munich now. He became one of a close personal friend, and we, our families, as wives and all, get together and visit, come and stay. He comes and stays with us when he's over here. But one of the nice things at this DuPont Association, it gave the time, the encouragement, money, for many young people here like myself to go over and with an entree to people like Wittig and Wiesken and all the rest, Prelog. And if you could bring science with you, you were very quickly very popular, because not only was it the science, but you represented an entree to America. So those were just outstanding, thrilling days. I can remember going to the ATI one time, and Prelog grabbed my wife and whisked. He had just separated from his wife. He grabbed my wife and whisked her away with him for the morning, telling a elderly American couple that were visiting him. I can't remember. He's a crystallographer, damn it. I can't remember his name. That my my wife was his new wife, and kept up this craziness for a whole morning until we all met for lunch at one of the guilds. But as I say, I got to know people well enough for for closeness to develop, and I really truly, if I was at an American university, I would have never had the opportunities I had that I think that came through DuPont.
Well, in many respects, you had a virtually academic setting without student
presence. Right. Well, Weiskin always called us the industrial university, and he always would refer us to CRD and lectures that he gave us this way. He was another one that followed up work. I worked on the mechanism of cycloaddition reactions, some of which is not quite right in there, and that was because we didn't have the tools to do the NMR types of resolutions, but some is correct. But we collaborated with Weiskin on some of them. He got interested in later and then followed up our stuff and showed that some of it was right and some of it was wrong.
Did you employ any of these people's consultants later on? That you met on your European trip?
I don't think we ever employed any of them as consultants. I think the theory behind all of this was that goodwill and sending us good potential students. Over the years, many of these people provided a lot of students who came over here to work for. So I'd say recruiting. If there was a company goal, it was probably more recruiting than anything else. And in any specific case, we probably would use some of these people as an ad hoc consultant or as a special, a special contract or something like that. But there was no program at all to have these people or anything other than the program was to develop close personal friendships. And the main idea was scientifically driven, and if there was any company side to it, it was probably the recruiting more than anything else.
You've mentioned that you had people like Blanchard, for example, who was essentially your postdoc and then
Brian
took off in the company.
Right.
How should I phrase this? What was the longevity of people coming into your group? People tend to stay? Did they move other parts of the company or leave the company?
Well, CRD was a reservoir of technical talent. When I first came here in the first several years that I was here, first decade I was here, a large number of research directors around DuPont were CRD people. Herm Schroeder started here. A lot of these people that had started out here. Maury Ernstberger, who became director of research at OrCam. Jerry Whitman. I can think of a lot of them. A lot of them had started here and went as a technical person to another department and went into the businesses. A lot of the guys had the real desire not to do science but to get into the mainstream and do things like that. So there was a fairly high turnover. The class that I came here with, there were 16 hired. By the way, 8 were men and 8 women.
Hmm.
It wasn't because we were out just trying to hire women. One of them was a PhD from MIT, Laura Kaiser, a little girl had been in a concentration camp. I lost thread of what we were
you were talking about the 18 that came here in your class.
Or 16. No, the... the turnover. Probably within 8 or 10 years, I was the only person left. And the theory at that time was that we would be an entrance port, and the really serious scientists, the best scientists, the ones who were most productive, would probably earn a slot to stay here. And the those others would probably move through to other places in the company. Strange as it may seem, this caused less problem than you thought, because competition was fairly high with the quality of folks here, and those folks who were asked or suggested that they might want to go on to an industrial department usually agreed that they, not always, but for the most part, people do see themselves more accurately than we give them, than we suspect they do sometimes. And as I say, a fair number of people, no matter what they say coming in here, actually end up wanting to go and get into the, they're lured on by management. And of course, management outside of here is, like many, many paths are open to you compared to the very small number in research. Turnover was fairly high, but even some of the best people ended up ultimately leaving, because somebody really wanted, the draw would be somebody in the industrial department had a position that they really wanted this person. They felt they could make a real contribution, and that, if you know you're really wanted, people tend to be more amenable to be drawn away. Chung Ho Park was an example of that. And he's with DuPont Merck now, and he's done extremely extremely well there.
Do you think that some of that movement into the out of the research end is partially because you really have to have a concerted effort to keep yourself on top of the science as it's changing over the years, as opposed to being in a business, not that it's not changing, I think keeping up with the science over a long period of time is quite demanding.
That is right, and I certainly think that's part of it. And there's no question that there are people that start out from graduate school believing they want to be a bench chemist. And I can think of a fellow that I was involved in hiring from Columbia. He was, I guess he was just finishing a postdoc in Columbia. I can't remember where he went before that. But he was a really exuberant guy and a very knowledgeable, very bright guy. After he'd been here for 2 or 3 years, he told me one day that what he really discovered he wanted to do was employee relations work. And I said, Fred G., I said, that's fine, I'll be glad to do this. But, he wasn't doing a bad job here at any means. He just decided that's what he wanted to do. So I gave up, guess he was a Breslau postdoc. Seen other guys that left here to become a go to Wall Street and do something. Mostly all of the ones that stay in the company and move, they transfer more or less laterally to become a research scientist in one of these departments where they can focus on more, and often they're pretty good people who can end up by having a very good career where they go. Some clearly know after 2 or 3 years here that what they want to do is to be director of research. The probability is low here, but they might be director of research over there, and they will leave here and maybe with a promotion to a research supervisor in another department, and if everything works okay, they go on up. and that's what happened in the past. A lot of people were ended up as the top management in these departments, often as the vice president of the department too. So we were for a long time a hot, big hiring pool. We became less and less important to the company that way by the middle 70s. And that doesn't mean we still don't, we still provide selective people of, I think, of real importance to the company. But as a broad concept of a big pool, that we were going to be a port, a hiring port, I think that has probably died away by the early 70s.
How did the how did the company react when you started publishing papers in the Journal of Chemical Physics?
By that time, I don't think no matter what your no matter what your status is here in terms of rank or that sort of thing, there's a sign. There's an unwritten scientific rank, and certainly the people in the department above me wouldn't have blinked an eye at that. I mean, they would have thought about this as just working across boundaries or something like that. Jeff, you have to, if you, I don't have the, I have, right next door, we have all the bound publications of Central Research going back to Carruthers Day, right back from Volume 1. And if you look at these publications in the heydays of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, you'll find everything under the sun in there. Every kind of thing.
So top management in the company would also have to be supportive to an extent, at least, in having this activity going on.
Yes, and what they are way, again in the heyday, they were way back. They took a view that science is great, science and technology is the basis of modern American society, and if you're going to create wealth, not just make money, that we want to do this through technology as a base. And we will put in so much money a year as an investment in this, and we don't want to try to guess what it is you ought to be doing. What we want to do is to have good people running things and leave it in their hands, and this is our high risk money, and what we hope is every several years you guys will come up with something that will do us some good. That view persisted for a long time, then it has wavered and changed as a function of the outside world and the company's fortunes and how the businesses are doing. There were those in the industrial departments who thought that the whole thing was a boondoggle, and that if we were going to earn our keep here, we ought to work on what they want us to do. And we've gone through periods of having as much as 20 or 25% of our programs funded by the departments. And that doesn't mean they tell us what to do, but it's a joint agreement of what it is you're going to work on. Then we go back down to zero. Then we may go up to 5 or 10% and go back down to 2%. So it's oscillated all around. Nowadays, the concept of this free industrial, that is a free approach to industrial science, do what you want to do and something that will come out of it, is pretty much dead all over the country. And it's pretty much dead here, too. And much of what we're doing is things that probably wouldn't get done in the industrial departments, but are much closer to their goals and needs. And often we have people here that can do things that just they can't do, or can't, or sometimes mechanistic people and what have you. So the future of corporate research, I don't, that's a mystery. DuPont's heritage is so strong that the chairman of DuPont have been loath to do anything drastic to it so far, but I don't know about next year or the year after that.
I was going to ask how you viewed what was happening with your counterparts, places like Dow and Monsanto and so on, over the time period that you've seen it, the changes. I guess DuPont was really the leader in this kind of research.
Well, there was a difference in this sense. Back in the early part of this century, all research was centralized here. Very early on was a laboratory was built at Eastern Lab over in New Jersey and the experimental station here. And the concept of a centralized operation started, I mean, that was the beginning of things. And from that, industrial department research grew, and for a long time, CRD supplied all of the, the pieces of it would break off and go over and become the explosives department or the fibers department or what have you, or they'd act as the nucleus for doing this. Most American industries are just the opposite. They had a plant doing this, a plant doing that, and a laboratory there, and so as a later afterthought, after World War II, people said, hey, we ought to have a central research. I remember when Triple M, the guy who was director of research, came out to see me one time, and I told him in detail all of how we were structured and what our philosophies were. And he went back and they called it the Central Research Department. They had an associate director. They had an exact duplicate of what we had. And so I'd say that things, the basic difference is that DuPont grew, everything grew out of the Central Research Department. These other companies had a Central Research Department much later as an afterthought. So hence, when things get tight, it was easier to do away with it at Shell or anybody or Monsanto. Even AT&T doesn't do as much as they used to. Any more to say about that except that DuPont is still keeping it alive, and I hope they do. But things got really bad. I suppose we would have trouble with it too.
How does this affect recruiting?
Well, recruiting, I haven't kept up with it closely, but I think the maximum we've been doing in the last a few years is just replenishing holes that really need to be filled. It's probably a slow downward drift. There's no desire to drive out so many people, but this more and more is becoming budget determined. Previously, all managements of DuPont corporate research, engineering, and central research have been determined by the executive committee. They would just say, this is set aside for you, and now we'll work on budgets. We had a budget, but I mean, they just came by waving the hand at the very top. This is not so now. CRG competes with other staff departments and what have you for budget. This makes it very painful. It's a process I didn't have to go to. They waited until after they got rid of me, then they could go and do this with you. I wouldn't do anything like that. So at any rate, the poor Al McLaughlin and others are having to struggle with that now. But it was just coming in when I left, and it's in the whole company, and it's moved much more rapidly. So corporate research does not have the supporters that were built into the system. The chairman, the executive committee, just don't exist anymore to do who can provide that sort of umbrella. So I don't know where that's going to all go.
I just had another question along that line. I've forgotten it. You've already commented about the future, and you're not clear now what's going to take place. But
I can tell you that if business turns up, all will be forgotten, and we'll get tons of money and go back to business as usual. The companies, hasn't been doing that well, but then again, they're doing is better than their competitors. So it's it depends on how you look at it. But there's a lot of gloom and doom around here these days that have to do with this. It's now 3 years of cost being the main cost cutting and reduction of size. But the fact is, going back 5 or 6 years, DuPont is too damn big. Too many people in the company. As an example, around 85, our vice president of corporate plans presented us with a figure one day that IBM, compared to DuPont, we have 8 times as many per capita employee relations people than IBM. Well, 8 times per capita. And this is because of this historic structure into all of these parallel independent departments, which have each had its own finance division, each had its own employee relations. And on top of all that, there's a corporate employee relations division. So, you know, if you have 8 departments, you probably have 8 times as many people as IBM does or something like that. It's roughly, it works out about roughly the same. Interestingly, corporate research has been, all of us who have run it over the years have done a very good job about not wasting money. There are a lot of things that we could lead a much more extravagant life here, and no one would say anything about it, especially in good times. And none of the heads have ever thought that was a very good idea, and I think all of us were right. And, I don't mean that we are niggardly, but nevertheless, we don't. People in the departments, if things are going well, they immediately find reasons to take their wives and all, everybody go off and have a celebration in the Bahamas or something like this and call it a business meeting or something. You know, but we never spent money for that sort of thing.